Last time we, the second hour, we worked on what is the third vision in Zechariah, and let me try just to tie together the first, second, and third visions and indicate the gist of what we want to do this evening, as we would plan to spend the first half of this evening on fleshing out the third vision, and then the second half of the evening to move into that central vision, which is the fourth vision in chapter 3. But right now, then, we just try to tie together the first triad, and especially to see what is new and distinctive in the third vision. In the first vision, you recall, the basic thought we tried to underscore was that of the divine presence, which was symbolized then in the form of the messianic angel, the rider on the red horse, who was located in the midst of the people of God, symbolized by the myrtles, and all of this in the face of the hostile deep of the nations. And so there is the presence of the Lord, who the angel who is judge of all the earth, and yet before the first vision is over is advocating the cause of the myrtle community, as he cries out how long, because the myrtle community, the saints, are in the midst of the difficulties, and the promises of the ultimate coming of the kingdom seem evening so far postponed and delayed that he has to cry out how long. And then there is the response of God, who comes and repeats the assurance of his own presence, and it's one that will bring then mercy to his people. And so you get the two prospects then. God is present, and what does this mean to his people? It means, on the one hand, that Jerusalem, Zion, the temple are going to be restored. On the other hand, it means that God is angry with the nations out there who are at ease and who have brought the people of God into their present unhappy, lowly circumstances. But the restoration and fullness of God's own people, on the one hand, the judgment of the nations on the other, those are the two things that can be anticipated because God is present in the midst of his people. The second vision, then, in this triad, picks up on the theme of the judgment of the nations and takes you beyond the threat of the first vision. In the first vision, God says that he's very angry with these nations who are at ease, but it doesn't then move into an actual description of the judgment. The second vision picks up on that, takes you the step further from the threat to the picture of the way in which the divine experts, the Harashim figures, are going to come and deal with these horn nations who have lifted up their horn against God's people and brought them low. And so we read the actual act of judgment, which is one then of casting down the horns, that complete reversal, that which is high is made low, and of course with the implication that which is low is going to be brought up high. But the second vision is more directly concerned with the judgment on the nations. The horns are going to be cast down, and we notice the alternative way of understanding the verb in that case was that it might have the thought of the horns will be cast out, as though it were sort of an incantation, an act of exorcism against these demonic nations who were oppressing God's people. And so it sort of picked up the strain of the satanic and the demonic I tried to begin to develop the last time, and we'll do more with that this evening. And then, of course, in the middle vision, the fourth vision, it becomes very much to the front. And there he is. There's the Satan figure in the fourth vision. So along the way, we're trying to pick up that theme and put our finger on it. And so in the second vision, the possibility of the imagery of the casting out, the act of exorcism as the form of judgment, the display of the sovereign power of the Lord who is present in the midst of his people. Well, now in the third vision, we have, again, the emphasis on the presence of God. Several times you get the refrain line, I will come and dwell in the midst of you, here in this third vision. But the basic symbolism of it picks up on that positive theme that we had in the first vision of the positive restoration of Zion and Judah and so on, because right away we're confronted with the symbolism of Jerusalem as an unbounded, even unwalled, so extensive is the thing, so prosperous, that it breaks through any thought of being contained within walls. It's an unwalled city. That's your basic symbolism. And then in the exposition of it that follows, well, obviously there is an interpretation of that symbol of the unwalled, unbounded city, and that symbol, that interpretation is in terms of a population explosion of the people of God, or looking at it from the point of view of the citizens of the city are out there. It's an influx, and not an explosion from within, but it's an influx of people of God from abroad that accounts for the growth of the city to these unprecedented extent. And more specifically, it's an influx of Gentiles, huh? And so now we are getting a new note within this development. It's the universalism of the new covenant age that is being anticipated. Now, in the Old Testament, it's characteristic of the whole Mosaic economy that you have an ethno-centralized. Everything is centered on one particular ethnic stock, the physical descendants of Abraham, as over against an inclusion of others who were farther abroad. But that there is, of course, the thought of time when the Gentiles are going to come into the picture, and this is very much to the fore now in the in the third vision. And so the unwalled city is explained in those terms, in terms of coming in of the Gentiles. But now what is also distinctive in this third vision is that, well, look, here we had these two thoughts. One was the restoration and multiplication of God's people and Zion over here, and over here is the judgment of the nations. And what's the connection between those two things? Is there a connection? Well, of course, right from the outset, we know there's a connection. Those nations over there are hostile to God's people. They're the ones who have brought them low and so forth. And so there is that kind of a connection. But what begins to emerge now in this third vision is that the judgment of the nations is somehow the cause of the happy developments or the turn of fortunes, the restoration of God's people. The fullness of Jerusalem is a consequence of the judgment on the nations. Now, how can that be? And the answer then turns on the thought that the judgment of the nations has the character of a plundering. It's a spoiling of the nations. The nations had plundered God's people, and now there's going to be this reversal. And so those who had been plundered are going to be the recipients of the fact that God is going to plunder the nations themselves. And it's comparable to the experience of the Israelites in Egypt, where the Exodus was a spoiling of the Egyptians. When you go out from the land, borrow, you know, from your neighbors before you go out, and of course, borrow to keep. And so the Israelites go out laden with the spoil of Egypt. The low are being raised up, and those who had plundered them these many years are now themselves being plundered. Well, that's the thought now that we get in this third vision, the spoiling or the plundering of the nations. And that plundering of the nations really has two aspects to it. The nations are plundered in terms of their outward glory. You might say in terms of their property, huh? Their earthly glory and so on. The day is coming. Haggai, the earlier contemporary of Zechariah, had emphasized how he's going to shake the heavens and the earth and the nations, and the glory of all the nations was going to be flowing into the ranks of God's people. So in terms of creation's glory, whatever it has to offer, the riches, the wealth, the glory of this world that God has made is taken then from the nations, and it is bestowed on God's people. The meek inherit the earth in those times. So that's one way in which God's judgment on the nations spoils. It's a spoiling of the nations in terms of their property, and with the correlative of that, the enrichment of God's people. But the other thing is the more interesting one, and that is that the judgment on the nations is a spoiling of the nations in the sense that it is a taking away of their people, and not just their property, but their people in the midst of the nations out there. There are all of these people who are, now here we're getting into the satanic aspect of it again. Here is Satan, the one who goes around deceiving all the nations of the world, keeping everybody in darkness. And so these nations, yes, they're hostile to God's people, but they're dwelling among them. There are those who are captives, who are the prey of Satan. And God's judgment on the nations then is a redemptive, it's a soteric kind of judgment that results in snatching away, spoiling Satan of these captives that he has, this prey that he has held. Here are God's elect out there among the nations, and the Lord judges the nations by claiming for himself and taking back for himself his own people. This is then how the Gentiles come streaming into Jerusalem and expand all of the boundaries. So that particular theme of the spoiling then of the nations, more particularly the spoiling of Satan, is one then that if you've been reading through Glory in Our Midst, I think, in there I do develop this, and I plan to do it in any case. What we're talking about here in the spoiling of the nations is something then, or of Satan, is something that Jesus picks up on when he talks about the strong man, you know, who has his captives, and then the stronger one, who is Jesus himself, who comes and spoils Satan of his captives. And in the Lucan version of that, you get the additional thought that before you can spoil the mighty warrior of his prey, you have to bind him. Huh? You have to bind him, and then you can enter his house and take away which belongs to him. And so you see, we are on a movement then that leads us right to the millennium passage in Revelation 20, which is dealing with precisely the same thing, so that we want to then pick up on that and trace this theme that we get in Zechariah's third vision through, and we'll start it in Isaiah 49, where we have the roots of the idea, and then through the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and then on into the Revelation 20. So that's at the heart of what we want to do along the way tonight. So that's where we're going, okay? And now let's see to... up, what's the best way to do this vision? I want vision. Where does vision 3 start? Vision 2. No, we don't want vision 2. We want vision 3. There it is. Okay. No page number. Maybe page 71. Okay. Page 71 if you want to try to coordinate what's going on here with your reading. Let's look at the text again. So if you have a Hebrew Bible, let's look at it again. And here we encounter that business of the different enumeration once again. And after this, we'll be clear of that problem. Once you get to chapter 3 in the fourth vision, then the Hebrew and English enumerations are the same. But on this third vision, we're still involved with that. And so let's see, in the Hebrew, it's chapter 2, verse 5. And let's see, in the English, is it chapter 2, verse 1? Verse 1, huh? Yeah. The third vision, yeah. Yeah, okay. So chapter 2, verse 1 in the English, or chapter 2, verse 5 in the Hebrew, where the prophet again says he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, and then he sees the basic symbolism here is the man, and in his hand there is the measuring cord. I said, where are you going? And he said unto me, la mode, from the verb madad, to measure Jerusalem. And lirot, from the verb ra'ah, to see what is its breadth and what is its length. And we talked about that and in terms of the verb ra'ah, to see, noted that it could be either a matter of going to see a vision, which at least in the experience of this angel, he could already see the finished Jerusalem there, and he goes to measure it and to see what its dimensions are, and then he reports that, so that the seeing would be sort of a matter of judgment. He goes to check it out to make sure that it's as he had planned and sovereignly decreed it, and of course, yes, it is. The other way of interpreting the ra'ah was that it has the thought of determining something, to make a choice with respect to something, and so that in this case he wouldn't be measuring the dimensions of a city already existing in his vision, but of determining what those dimensions should be, and so the sovereign determinative role of this measuring figure would be even clearer on that basis. But we already then have this figure of a man with a measuring rod. In the opening vision, he was a man who was a rider on the red horse. He was the messianic angel. And here this figure with the measuring rod is once again that figure of the messianic angel. And so one of the first points then that we take up is, the dignity of this messianic angel, is it sort of undercut by having him engage in such a menial task of just going around measuring the things? And we try to argue, no, this is not some menial chore. This is the sovereign activity of a royal figure. So now where do I discuss the page 72 is just trying to sort out all the different figures that are involved, the interpreting angel and so on, and we established the thesis that the man with the measuring line is the angel of the Lord. Yeah, all right. And that discussion carries over onto the top of page 73. And now, trying to argue the case for that, the second paragraph on page 73, support for our conclusion that the measurer is the divine angel, are other biblical instances of measuring as a divine activity. So if we're surprised by God being involved in divine activity here, we shouldn't be, because this is something we encounter elsewhere. So possession and use of the measuring line in this passage signifies that the man is not merely some subordinate surveyor gathering information, but it's the Lord himself engaged in sovereign construction. So the man with the measuring line is another way of describing God. He is the one who is the builder and the maker, the New Jerusalem, the eternal city that Abraham is looking for, whose builder and maker is God, builder and maker, architect and artisan. That's the idea, the man with the measuring line. So it's not some menial second-rate chore. This is the one with sovereign determination. That would fit in very nicely then with that second meaning, as I suggested, of Ra'ah, to see that he is the one who goes out to determine what these measurements are going to be. So by the stretching out of the measuring lines, the perimeters were set. Zechariah here in the third vision is picking up on the promise back in the first vision that a line would be stretched forth over Jerusalem as part of the process of rebuilding the city and the temple. So as we said, the first vision has the theme of the restoration of the city and the judgment of the nations. And here in the third vision, we are getting that first theme, the rebuilding of the city in terms now of this measuring, establishing its boundaries. And of course, the other thing, as we said, is there too, the theme of the judgment and what the connection is going to be between them. Like this third vision of Zechariah, then we have Jeremiah 31. Now, when we say Jeremiah 31, what do we think of right away? I would expect that we think of that much quoted passage in the New Covenant, New Testament, where Jeremiah 31 turns out to be a classic parade prophecy of the New Covenant, not like that covenant which I made with your fathers when I brought them out of the land of Egypt, which covenant of mine they broke, even though I was faithful to them, and so on. Not like that covenant, but in the coming days, I'm going to make a new covenant. Remember that famous passage. A new covenant, which will not be a covenant of works, which could be broken like the Mosaic covenant, but which will be one which is characterized by grace and forgiveness and so forth. So that's the Jeremiah 31 passage. Now, there's evidently then something nearby that I'm calling attention to here where you get the idea of the building. Jeremiah 31 prophesies of the new covenant restoration, the verses we just sort of quoted, under the imagery of a rebuilding of Jerusalem. And now this is then helpful, you know, and here we are working on Zechariah. And is he just talking about Israelites coming back from Babylon and setting up a city there in Palestine and in Jerusalem? Well, the way in which Jeremiah 31, in a passage that we all recognize has to do with the New Covenant, uses that same rebuilding symbolism, tells us, no, Zechariah here is using prophetic idiom. He's using the contemporary typological phenomena of his day in order to portray the messianic, antitypical realities of the New Covenant. So let's see then in Jeremiah 31, it would be verses 38 through 40, let's see what they say. The days are coming. Yeah, he has said that, you know, the days are coming when I'm going to make a new covenant. Well, in those same days, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when this this city will be rebuilt for me. And then it gives different points in its boundaries. And verse 39, the measuring line will stretch forth from there straight to the hill of Garab and so on. So it's the same imagery of the measuring line that we have in Zechariah 2, the man with the measuring cord. That's something then that will take place under the new covenant. And of course, under the new covenant, it's Messiah will be that one who does this. The city will never again be uprooted or demolished. And then I guess it's in the bottom of page 73 and top of 74 that I actually get into that discussion of the verb ra'ah, which we have already discussed how it can mean to determine the boundaries. So accordingly, now I'm on page 74, accordingly the role of the measurer in Zechariah's third vision is equally with that of the rider of the red horse in the first vision, compatible with the divine dignity. This is not something beneath his dignity. Compatible with the divine dignity of the angel of the Lord. Now, another extensive place in which you get the thought of a divine angel who engages in the measuring of the city is big section at the end of the prophecy of Ezekiel, chapter 40 through 48. And you can turn there if you want. I won't take the time myself to do that. I'll just read then Ezekiel 40 through 48 provides another extended example of a visionary appearance of the messianic angel in the form of a man with a measuring line. And you can check out those verses. In that case, the purpose of his measuring is to reveal to the prophet Ezekiel that is the Lord's own sovereign design for his temple kingdom. Here again, in Old Testament symbolism, is a portrayal of the ultimate new covenant messianic kingdom. And as we said, God is the builder and maker of that ultimate city. And here he reveals it to Ezekiel. Then likewise in the book of Revelation, again, in reinforcing the point that the measuring activity is compatible with the dignity of the divine angel, it was compatible with the figure of Christ, who of course is the divine angel become incarnate. And in the book of Revelation, possession of the measuring rod is attributed to Christ. And I'm thinking of Revelation 11. And again, it is a sign of his authority over God's house. So the measuring line, I don't know if I mentioned it here, but in extra-biblical texts from the ancient world, you see gods who have as their sort of sign of office and so on, measuring rods and so on. So this is a characteristic of a function of deity, even outside the Bible. But we're more interested then within the Bible here in Revelation 11. In Revelation 11, the one who charges John with the judicial use of the rod is identified as Christ when he goes on to speak of his commissioning of my two witnesses. And then again in Revelation 21:15, it's an angel sent by Christ to John who has the golden reed with which he measures the New Jerusalem and so on. So measuring activity is something that is directly assigned to the Lord Christ, and then God in general. And here we come back to the creation. God in creation was a building activity. This business of the building of the New Jerusalem is recreation. It's the equivalent of the creation of the new heavens and the new earth. And so what's going on here is a repetition of what God, Elohim, the creator at the beginning of the world, did. And so now what I'm interested in are those passages in Job, where Job has been crying out for his day in court, and at last God appears, and when he appears, and he begins to catechize Job, and he throws at him all these questions he can't answer, one in a thousand of them, starting with, where were you when I was creating the world, and so on. And in connection with that, then the Lord begins to describe his own creation of the world in terms of sort of the role of an architect and a builder. So measuring activity is also attributed to God in his creation of the world, which is his cosmic temple, his cosmic city. We read that he stretched out the measuring line at the laying of the foundation of the earth, Job 38:5. He measured out the heavens with the span. And now we're in Isaiah 40, verse 12. And then back in Job 28:25, God meted out the waters and the land by measure. So God is one who's going about measuring and weighing and doing all the sorts of things that the man with the measuring line in Zechariah 2 also describes. So summing up now, this background of divine acts of measuring performed in execution of sovereign decree and in determination of the boundaries of God's house and city corroborates the identification of the man with the measuring line in Zechariah 2 as the angel of the Lord. So that's our thesis. Who is this figure? He is the messianic angel, and all of this supports it. He is the Word of God, this man with the measuring line. He is the Word of God who was in the beginning with God, who was God, the maker of all things, visible and invisible. The measurer is the Creator Lord, seen by Zechariah as now engaged in redemptive recreation as the architect, the almighty constructor of the new cosmos, the heavenly city, New Jerusalem. So that's the grand scope, I think, that we should capture as we read here in the symbol of the man with the measuring line. Well, then the next main symbol that we encounter there, of course, is the city itself. Where's my coffee? The old tonsils are already beginning to get scratchy. Well, that involves then reading a little bit more from the text. So we read about the man with the measuring line, and seeing him, the prophet right away asked where he's going, and he's told in order to measure Jerusalem to see what its length and breadth are, and then the report comes in a rather complicated way. In verse 7, we now have the interpreting angel brought into the scene. And behold, the Malach Adoverbi, the angel who was speaking with me, Yotzei. I think I did mention that sometimes this particular Hebrew verb, which means we would normally translate it to go out, in the form of a vision, seems to have the force of to appear. So here's Zechariah looking, waiting for what's going to see next. And the next thing that that appears in his vision is this interpreting angel now comes into view. But not alone, opposite him, there is another angel. And without going through all of that again, this other angel, if it is not the angel with the measuring line himself, it is someone who now is sent to him, just as Christ in the book of Revelation sends an angel messenger to John. So here it could be that the messianic man with the measuring line sends a servant angel of his with his message to the interpreting angel, to be conveyed in turn to Zechariah, this young man. But in any case, the ultimate, that's the important thing, is the ultimate speaker here is the one who went forth to measure things, and now he reports the results of his measuring. And so he said unto him, run now and speak to this young man and say, now here's the message that comes as the result of this activity of the man with the measuring line. Pirat zot teshev Yerushalayim. Jerusalem is going to literally sit, dwell, like the unwalled villages outside the regular walled towns, and then spread out without walls around them, these unwalled villages, and that seems to be the point that it doesn't have a wall. It's not like the Perizzot villages out there. And in this case, however, the reason for the absence of the wall is Meirov Adam Uvechema Betoka, because of the population explosion. The superabundance of people and their animals are just going in all directions and can't be contained by walls. And so there's your symbol now. The unwalled city of Jerusalem, unwalled, and not because the enemies have knocked the walls down and they haven't had a chance to restore them, but unwalled because they're too prosperous. God has prospered them too much to be contained in the normal way. And all right, now then, coming back to glory in our midst, that's the symbol then that we pick up on page 74 at the bottom, the city of glory. Now this symbol of the city of Jerusalem, the city of God, of course, to follow. And that's what we keep on doing. I'm sure you see, in here we come to the book of Zechariah, and we have all of these symbols and details. And what we're trying to do is to see how they fit in a theme or a topic that goes back much earlier and goes beyond them at the same time. Well, here in dealing with this theme of the city, of course, the roots of that take us right back to the Garden of Eden, and the whole mandate that God gives to man from the beginning can be conceptualized in terms of the city of God. They start, of course, in the garden, but they are not to remain there. They have a mandate to achieve an earth-wide, a global mastery involving the filling and subduing of the earth. The idea of filling it, well, that's what we're getting here, the city that's really filled, filled to overflowing. Here's the fulfillment of the original mandate that was given to Adam, the cultural mandate, the creation commission, given right from the beginning. Apart from the fall, the garden would have been extended in all directions until it was the global city of God, a theocratic city, with its focus there at the mountain of God in Eden, the mountain of assembly where heaven projected through and came down to earth, and the glory of God crowned the mountain in Eden, God in the midst of his cherubic angel council. All are present there, and that's the focus, that's the cultic focus of man's life in the garden, and it would have remained so, I would suppose, as man expanded the perimeters of the garden to become the city, yet the coherence and the unity and focus of the whole thing on God himself and his holy glory presence on the mountain of Eden, I think would have been maintained. Well, that was not achieved that way because Adam fell. And instead of the garden expanding then and becoming the global city, you have an altogether different situation. You have common grace, common curse coming in. You have the city idea is picked up again in terms of common grace, but it's no longer the holy city of God with the glory presence of God there in the midst of the thing anymore. It's the common grace city. And, well, it's a long and a complicated story with its pseudo attempts that we've talked about in recent weeks, as at the Tower of Babel, huh? There's the city of man, and perversely attempting to reestablish the connection with heaven that was lost, the mountain of God, by building the Ziggurat mountains and so on. But what man by his works cannot achieve, meanwhile, by the principle of grace, God does have in view, and he offers it to his people in promise. So Genesis 11 is the failure of the Tower of Babel episode and the reversal and the high brought low down there. We talked about that in dealing with the second vision. But then the very next chapter in Genesis 12, you have God coming to Abraham with the promise of the city. And the book of Hebrews tells us that Abraham himself understood enough of the real meaning of that promise so that he was looking for the ultimate city, which was the one originally in view with Adam that he failed to achieve. But Abraham's messianic seed was going to achieve it as the second Adam. And so that global city is theocratic city of God with the God's glory revealed in the midst of it. That would be achieved again at the end of the days. And meanwhile, here we are in the Old Covenant, and here is the purpose of the Mosaic economy for one thing, was to provide a sort of a prototypal, anticipatory experience of what the ultimate goal was. And so God provides that, of course, in Zion, in Jerusalem, then pick up where Adam lost it back at the beginning. And here, by God's grace, God is providing the new paradise land with the new mountain of God in the midst, crowned by the new city and the new a temple of God, the new Jerusalem. So Adam's job would have been to build the big city, to take it as far as he could, which I call megapolis. Huh? So the big city, the global city, is what Adam should ultimately have achieved, but he could only take it so far. And at that point, God himself must step in and do something which would be just as decisive as his original creation, namely his consummating of the world, his glorifying of the human community. And so as far as man could take it would be to develop this human, theocratic, holy community to the planet-wide extent, but it would still be composed of of earthy people, like the first man who was of the earth earthy, and yet God's ultimate plan involves an eschatology that goes beyond the original creation to a state of consummation, which for man involves that he's going to have a glorified body. And so man creates or should have created the big city, megapolis, but then God must step in when he was satisfied now that the earth was filled enough and bring things to their Sabbath consummation by glorifying mankind. And so God would establish the beyond city, beyond what man himself, even in a sinless state, could do. God, by this supernatural act of glorification, would do. It's the beyond city. Therefore, I use the Greek word meta in the sense of beyond, and I say that the ultimate goal originally was metapolis. That was the eschatological end result of a successful probation. That, in other words, heaven. Heaven is that ultimate big city. It's not just paradise regained. It's as though it's just the simple garden. No, we're beyond the simple garden. It's paradise regained but consummated. Huh? It's mankind culturally formed into the city of God. That was the ultimate goal. And as we've said in other connections, that ultimate goal in the wisdom of God is something that has to be earned. Heaven must be earned. And then it was Adam's task to earn it in the first case, and he failed to do it. Now Christ comes into the picture. He is the one who earns it. And he is the builder of Metapolis, only now the name for Metapolis is Jerusalem, the New Jerusalem, okay? So in a redemptive dialect, Metapolis becomes Jerusalem, New Jerusalem. And that's what Zechariah 2 is picturing, huh? It's this original ultimate goal of a human existence, the city, the eternal city of God. And here it is. And it's a city without walls. So then, this global city was to be transformed by the Creator Spirit into Metapolis, the beyond city of eternity. There, the glory, no longer just a local focus, would fill the cosmos, permeating the fullness of Metapolis. In other words, I think of heaven, and it isn't just that in one spot in heaven, someplace, there will be the glory of God, and elsewhere there won't be. No, the global city is one which is an expansion of the mountain of God, the glory of God's sight itself, so that the whole thing is filled with the glory of God. And of course, we get a suggestion of that now in Zechariah's visions here. When he speaks of himself, God says, I am the glory in the midst of it, and I am, we'll come to that in a little bit here. This unwalled city actually turns out to have a wall, but God is the wall. Huh? It's the glory of God is the wall. So he's the wall of fire around it. At the same time, he's the glory in the midst of it. He permeates, he saturates, the glory of God fills the whole place. The whole thing is one cosmic holy of holies. Therefore, it's in a cuboid shape. The New Jerusalem, when it's described, is in the shape of the holy of holies, a cube. And the New Jerusalem is the new heavens and the new earth. It's a cosmic holy of holies with the glory of God filling the whole thing. Well, that's getting a little beyond Zechariah here at this point. So New Jerusalem is that metapolis arrived at by way of redemptive recreation in the symbolic portrayal of it in Zechariah 2, its fullness is the theme in verse 8 and its glory focus in verse 9. All right, and then I'd pick up this parazote. It will be like a patchwork of country settlements of men and cattle by reason of its abounding population. We're dealing with verse 8. It would not have the bounding walls characteristic of ancient cities. The outworking of this prophetic symbolism in New Covenant history is then expounded in the following verses. But the roots of this thought of the huge enlargement of the community of God's people, the roots of that idea, then I say go way back to the Oracle of Noah. Well, let's do that. As I said, at each point we want to then see where Zechariah fits into the whole trajectory from earlier prophecies to later fulfillments. And now here we are dealing with the thought of this eschatological Jerusalem, this unwalled, unbounded city. And the roots of that go back to Genesis 9. And, well, let's see. Well, some of you, not all of you, were in the class, I guess it would have been 2 years ago, where we worked through some of these things in the early chapters of Genesis, and including Noah's oracle. So this is taking us quite a way back from Zechariah to the roots of the idea of the city that was whose unprecedented growth was due, especially as we've already seen, is going to be to the coming in of the Gentiles. That's going to be the message here in Zechariah, to the big city due to the coming in of the Gentiles. Where does that idea start? So let's turn, and if you can find it in your Hebrew Bible, Genesis 9, or in your English Bible, it's going to be the same thing, Genesis 9, verses 24 through 27. Let's take a look at it. And here's a handy little Hebrew Bible. Vest pocket, New Testament Greek isn't too bad, but vest pocket Hebrew is a little harder. I don't know if this is really vest pocket, bulging vest pocket. But Genesis 9, here's Noah, and well, we need to go into the whole background and everything, and you know the activity of the three sons and the evil activity of Ham, but the pious activity of Shem and Japheth. And Noah awakes, and he knows the mischief that the son Ham has done. And so he proceeds now to utter this oracle, which is to start with, at least it's a curse on Ham for the evil thing that he has done. But then the occasion is taken to pronounce blessings also on the other two boys who have performed the godly act of covering over their father's shame. And it's in connection then with the blessings on Shem, and especially the blessing on Japheth, that we have, I think, the roots of the unwalled city of Zechariah too. So if we look at verse 24... well, Noah awoke from his wine and so on. And verse 25, and he said, then he pronounces a curse, Arur Kinaan, cursed be Canaan. And of course, Ham was the one who had performed the evil deed, but then Canaan is his son, and the curse is going to actually fall on the line of Ham through the Canaanite branch, and of course, in the form of the Canaanites. Later on, and so the curse actually then specifies the name of Canaan, and part of the reason for plugging in the name of Canaan rather than the father Ham is in order to facilitate a pun. Remember, we discussed this maybe or not, but in each of these cases, whether curse or blessing, the name is taken as a basis for the prophecy. The nomen is an omen, and so in the case of the curse. The curse is going to be, of course, looking ahead to the way in which the Israelites later come in and dispossess the Canaanites, who are the descendants of Ham through this son, Canaan. And so there's a play on the name Canaan, because the verb kana, means to subjugate, to subdue. And so here there's a curse now on Canaan, which you're your name already embodies that thought of being you are going to be subjugated. When the time comes for this great typological judgment, typological of the final judgment of all evil, the Canaanites are going to be overcome by God's own people. It will be part of the blessing. These things are always, as we've seen here in Zechariah 2, the restoration of God's people is tied in very closely. In fact, as a consequence of the judgment of the world. The world has to be dispossessed we see here in Zechariah 2, the world has to be dispossessed in order for God's people to enter into their possession again. And the whole experience of Israel illustrates that. The Canaanites had to be dispossessed in order for the Israelites to go in and occupy the promised land. And so here's the prophecy of that curse. Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants will he be to his brothers. And that's that's the imagery of election and reprobation. So just as with Jacob and Esau, the elder will serve the younger, means Esau, I have hated, Jacob, I have loved. And so here, when it speaks about the Canaanites as being a servant to their brothers, it's another way of saying that the Canaanites are the objects of reprobation, and the Shem and Japheth are going to be the recipients of blessing. And by the way, another general hermeneutical principle that you may remember that we brought out in discussing this passage is that in the case of each of these things, whether the curse or the blessing, it isn't saying that every last descendant of Ham or of Canaan was reprobate, any more than it's saying that every last descendant of Shem was blessed or every last descendant of Japheth was blessed. All it is saying is that in the course of history, in each case, there would be some outstanding notable example of curse or blessing. In the case of Canaan, that big notable example was, of course, the story of the Israelite holy war against Canaan. But, you know, elsewhere there are Canaanites and Hamites who are believers and so on. and then moving on to the other two boys, the Shem and Japheth, you know, they had entered into the tent where Noah was lying naked. And it was there in the tent that Shem and Japheth, operating together, putting the blanket or whatever over their shoulders, walking backwards and putting over, it was in the tent that they performed their godly deed of covering over sins, godlike. It reminds us of what God back in Genesis 3:21 does with Adam and Eve, their naked, shameful nakedness. God provides a covering over them. Huh? And the story in Genesis 9 of Shem and Japheth shows then that, you know, they are being recreated in the image of God once again, redemptively, and they are acting like God himself back in Genesis 3. They are covering over sins and so on, which is the opposite of what Satan does. He uncovers them. And Ham, Canaan, was acting like Satan. He exposes shameful nakedness. But Shem and Japheth, and in the tent, notice, it's in the tent that they do this together. And so as we read now, come to the punchline that I'm after here in the blessing of Japheth, we come again to the way in which Shem and Japheth are going to share together in a tent experience, namely in the covenant tents. That's getting ahead of the story. So first then, there's the blessing on Shem. And it says then, and he said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. Canaan will be a servant to them. The doxology, the blessing so great that instead of just being in the form of a benediction, it's a doxology. God's being praised right away for bestowing such a blessing on Shem. And what was the blessing on Shem? Well, it's the blessing embodied in the very thought that God is the God of Shem. Blessed be the Lord who is the God of Shem. That was Shem's blessing, that he was identified with the name of God. And there's the pun, of course, because Shem means name. And so the blessing on Shem, which means the name, is that he is going to bear the name of God. In other words, the covenant relationship. And so he was going to be brought into a relationship where God's whole glory and honor and cause was identified with this particular redeemed people that he was claiming for himself, snatching them out of the clutches of Satan. And so this was the glory of Shem. And of course, it begins to come to very notable fulfillment in Abraham. As we said, not all the descendants of Shem were by any means believers, but here with this one outstanding line, the line of Abraham, with whom all the rest of the biblical covenant is then identified as God makes this Abrahamic covenant. And among the promises of the Abrahamic covenant, of course, the messianic seed will come, and Abraham, through this messianic seed, will be the father of many nations. So now we're getting into our theme of universalism again. picked up in the Abrahamic promises. But that universalism was already back here in Genesis 9, in the last element, in Noah's prophecy as he moves from Ham, Canaan, to Shem, now finally to Japheth. And so we look now at verse 27, Genesis 9:27, and if you listen to the sound of it, you'll catch the pun in the Hebrew. Japheth is the name, Japheth, and the verb that is used is a verb patah, and in the form here it is yaft. Yaft Elohim b'yefet. Yaft yefet. Yaft yeft is the pun. And so punning on the name of Japheth, the Lord uses this verb, which is rare, and sometimes, in fact, very often, is translated to enlarge, but which perhaps has more warrant for being translated to open. But either one is maybe a possibility. So it's going to be enlarge or to open. But in either case now, the question is, in what way is there going to be an enlarging or an opening for Japheth, and how is that going to be a blessing? And all too often, this thing is misunderstood as though it were saying, well, look, the covenant blessings were going to be given to Shem. We've already had that. Now, Japheth's not going to be cursed, but he's not going to get covenant blessings either. He's just going to get some big common grace blessings. And so the thought then that it misses the point entirely in my judgment. But the thought is then that, well, the Japhethites were spread out geographically over quite a vast area. And so in terms of God's common grace apportioning of earthly turf to people, the Japhethites got quite a big share of it. But the spiritual blessings were with Shem. Now, that misses the whole point of it. Here, Shem and Japheth together had performed this godly act, and now together they are going to share in the redemptive covenantal blessings. And so the actual picture then is God is going to enlarge it or open it for Japheth, and enlarge what? Open what? The next clause tells you. So that he may dwell in the tent of Shem. So the blessing ends up where the pious deed began. It all begins in the tent, and it ends up now in the covenant tent. So because Shem, in terms of the Abrahamic covenant, had the privilege in these Old Testament days of occupying the covenant tent in fellowship with God, but it wasn't yet much of a time for Gentiles to be coming in. That was, however, the future. Then that's what Zechariah 2 in our vision is looking forward to, beyond that present Old Testament situation. He's looking to the new covenant situation when the Gentiles will become pouring in and occupy with the elect Jews the covenant tent, the fellowship with God. And then that's the root then of this whole thought of the Gentiles coming in and sharing with the Israelites. You move on then on to the scriptures here in Zechariah, and when you come to the new covenant, you see that as a matter of fact, yeah, it wasn't just Japhethites, but all the nations of the world. As a matter of fact, I think there is a rather specific fulfillment of this promise in terms of Japhethites, because the Greeks were descendants of the Japhethites, and the Greeks traced themselves through Helen to Prometheus to Iapetus, which is Japheth. So the Greeks in their own understanding of their own ethnic backgrounds traced themselves to Japheth, and so here we are with the Greeks, and here is the new covenant, and here is Paul, who is sent out as the apostle to the Gentiles. And lo and behold, in terms of the vision of the man of Macedonia, Paul goes zooming into the territory of the Japhethites, of the Greeks, and he carries out his mission. So I would see that as a very pointed and immediate and specific carrying out of this oracle of Noah. And the thought that you get here of the opening of the tent, huh? Open up the tent so that the Japhethites can come in is found actually in Paul's way of reporting when he had his furlough from his mission trip, and he reports of the big open door that God has opened for the Gentiles and so on. So I think Paul was thinking of this passage back in Noah. Now halfway between Noah and Paul, well, you might say it was Zechariah too, but which is where we're ending up here. But also there is Isaiah, and all the way through here there is so much in Zechariah that is taken over from Isaiah. And so here again, let's get a passage in Isaiah 54. So again, if you want to turn the Hebrew Bible to Isaiah 54, or in your English, we'll just read the opening two or three verses here in this chapter. Isaiah 54, he begins, Rani, sing, O barren woman who has not borne children. Break forth into song and shout for your result, you who have not labored in childbirth. And so now here it's talking about our city. This is the city of Jerusalem, conceived of as the mother of her population, of her children. And here's Mother Jerusalem, and she is she has been the married wife, and you might think of the days of David and Solomon, the period of the most extensive population in the Promised Land and the kingdoms of David and Solomon. But that's not where things are now in Isaiah's vision. And Isaiah is visioning that they are going to go into exile. And now she's going to be the desolate one. Now, this new condition of exile, and you wouldn't expect that out of this unpromising exile situation that there could be a brighter future than Jerusalem had experienced in the past back there in David and Solomon. But lo and behold, that's exactly what is going to happen. Jerusalem is going to become an unwalled city. It's so great, it's going to be the abundance of the people in it. And that's the point then that is brought out here. So break into song here, you who in your exile desolation seem to be bereft of your children. Why? Because more are the children of the Shomemah, the desolate one, Jerusalem, in this desolate post-exilic state, than the children of the married one, says the Lord. Because this post-exilic state, although outwardly it never attained again to the glory, even in form of the temple, let's say, of the Solomonic days, was going to be the thing that led into the new covenant and the Messianic temple and the Messianic New Jerusalem and the coming in of the Gentiles. So that in this stage that seemed as if all was lost and the nations are triumphant and there's no more Davidic dynasty, nevertheless, somehow God, out of this even fall of Israel, is going to bring to pass the fullness of Israel and the fullness of Jerusalem. More are the children of the desolate woman than the children of the married one, says the Lord. And so now the thought of the unbounded city is described in the form of an imperative. Enlarge, Mekom Ahalek, enlarge the place literally of your tent. And the curtains of your dwelling, it's changes from second person to third here. The curtains of your dwelling, let them stretch out. And do not restrain, but lengthen your cords and strengthen your stakes. And then the third verse, because to the right hand and to the left, they are going to spread abroad. Now, there's your thought of the population explosion, huh? To the right hand and to the left, they are going to spread abroad, and your children will possess the nations. Now, there's your imagery again of the Canaanites being dispossessed, God's people taking possession of their promised land. Your children will take possession of the nations and the desolate cities that they will occupy. So all of the same imagery keeps cropping up. And so Isaiah here is picking up on Noah's oracle of the Japhethites coming in, and he pushes it forward, and Zechariah plugs into that imagery, and you get to the New Testament, and it fills it up still more. So Isaiah, foreseeing this same development, when Zion's children would inherit the Gentiles, employed anew the tent metaphor. You see, there, and that's what I was getting at. It's the tent metaphor of Noah's oracle that Isaiah uses here to describe this development. Enlarge the place of your tent and so forth. And there elsewhere, too, in Isaiah, let's look at Isaiah 60. This is a favorite theme of Isaiah, is this very thing, the unexpected fullness of the people of God that's going to develop under the new covenant. And Isaiah 60, in prophesying of of this prospect, Isaiah also resumed Noah's image of the opening of an entrance. And so that's the way I favor understanding that. May God open wide for Japheth in the tent of Shem. I think basically it's the opening wide of the tent, but it involves also enlarging the whole structure. Isaiah describes Zion's gates of praise as wide open continually to welcome the Gentiles coming with their worshipful tribute to the Holy One of Israel. That's Isaiah 60, verses 11 through 14. Foreigners will rebuild your walls, and their kings will serve you. Though in anger I struck you, in favor I will show you compassion. And the children of the desolate will be more than the children of the married woman. Your gates will always stand open to let those Gentiles in, huh? They will never be shut day or night, so that men may bring you the wealth of the nations. Their king is led in triumphal possession. Here's this theme of the spoiling of the nations, you see. All the glory of the nations comes into God's people, but more pointedly, the remnant of the people who are held captive in those foreign nations, they will be streaming into Jerusalem as well. For the nation or kingdom that will not serve you will perish, it will be utterly ruined. The glory of Lebanon will come to you, and so on. The sons of your oppressors will come bowing before you. All who despise you will bow down at your feet, and will call you the city of the Lord. Okay, here is this city, this metropolis, the city of the Lord, Zion, the Holy One of Israel. Earlier in the chapter, the theme of the Gentiles streaming in has been found. Let's look at it, especially verse 3 and 4, Isaiah 60. Nations will come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. Lift up your eyes and look about you. All assemble and come to you. Your sons come from afar, and your daughters are carried on the arm. And verses 9 and 10, the whole theme is a picture of the wealth and so on of all the nations. So all directions come streaming into the city of God. Surely the islands look to me. In the lead are the ships of Tarshish, bringing your sons from afar with their silver and gold to the honor of the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel. For he has endowed you with splendor. Foreigners will build your walls. Their kings will serve you. Though in anger I struck you, in favor I will show you compassion. Your gates will always stand open. And so forth. And then in the rest of that paragraph on the top of page 76, I cite the way in which Paul referred to the open door of faith unto the Gentiles, Acts 14:27, and the feature of the gates perpetually opened to afford access for the nations of the earth is present once more in John's vision of the eternal city in Revelation 21, 24, and 25. Remember there, the gates are always opened as well. So that's where Zechariah 2, I would suggest, fits in this wonderful, rich theme. Goes from Genesis through Revelation, literally. So here's where Zechariah fits. The tent imagery of Noah is replaced by that of the city, as is the case also in Isaiah and John. But central here again is the theme of the extraordinary expansion to be undergone by the covenant community due to a great influx of Gentiles. It is this unprecedented development to occur in the coming age that Zechariah portrays under the symbolism of a Jerusalem where the customary walls are no more. And then the next couple of paragraphs, I see that trying to show that all of this involves not just a fulfillment of Noah's oracle, but it also involves a fulfillment of the promised blessing on Shem and the covenant blessings to Abraham as well. Now the top of page 77, moving on from verse 8 to verse 9 in our text. What's happening to the clock up there behind me? Yeah, better make a little more progress. Zechariah 2 now. Let's look at in the Hebrew. It would be verse 9. Verse 8 was Jerusalem would dwell like unwalled villages. Now verse 9. And I will be to it, says the Lord, Chomat Esh Zaviv. I will be to it a wall of fire round about. U'lekavod echia bitoka. And I will be also the kavod, the glory, in the midst of it. Which is saying God will be all in all. In the middle of it, he's there. Round about them, he is there. And so, paradoxically, the unwalled city does have a wall, only it's God himself is the wall. Paradoxically, the unwalled eschatological Jerusalem, Zechariah 2, has a wall around it. By filling the city right to its distant horizon, the divine glory constitutes a wall of fire around it there at its perimeter. And however, the idea is not that the city has no ordinary walls, because the fiery divine wall replaces such. Now, elsewhere you do get that idea when it's talking about the New Jerusalem and the new creation, and there won't be any need. There won't be a temple there because God is the temple, and there won't be any need for a light there because the glory of God is there. And so you might think that that's the point here, that this city doesn't have walls because God is the wall, but that's not quite the point. We already know, the text has already told us, it doesn't have walls because it has so many people in it and so much cattle. So the verse 5, I guess it was, gave us that particular explanation back there. So as we've seen, the absence of the customary walls is clearly accounted for by the city's overflowing population. But nevertheless, there is this thought that God himself does constitute around them a wall, and so I raised the question of what the function is. What's the function of the divine wall of fire around the city? And I guess I do trace, I should have if I don't, yeah, I do trace it back to Genesis 3. And of course, what is the function of the divine, or at least cherubim wall of fire with the flaming sword around the Garden of Eden? Is it to protect the Garden of Eden from attack, to guard it in that sense? And I think not. It's to protect it from the encroachment of that which would defile. Adam and Eve are the ones who are defiled and who must not be allowed in their defilement back in. And the sword of fire of the cherubim is to guard the sanctity of the garden, not the security of it. And I think that's the point here in Zechariah 2. Help in determining the function of the divine wall of fire comes again from Revelation 21. In Revelation 21, verses 12 following, it speaks about a great high wall. Here we are in heaven, and under the symbolism, there's a great high wall around us. Symbolic of something, of course, of some divine activity. What's the purpose of it? Well, it can't be that there are some enemies lurking around that might be attacking us there. So it's a question of protecting our security. All of our enemies are in the lake of fire, beyond touching us, harming God's people, or influencing them in any way. The great gulf is fixed, and so it's not the thought of security, but the thought is clearly that only the pure enter into the New Jerusalem, huh? and outside of the dogs, et cetera, all, everything which is sinful, which is not allowed to enter. And the wall of fire, I take it then, is one which is God's burning purity and holiness, which guards the sanctity of his holy place of presence from the encroachment of anything that would defile it. So this fiery wall, a manifestation of God's holiness, acts primarily as a guardian not of the security of the city, but of its sanctity. It harks back to the Garden of Eden sanctuary and the wall of fire and so forth. But the glory of the gospel comes out here too. You know, that here this heavy emphasis on keeping out anything that's impure, and yet the people who actually enter here in droves from all directions are all of them sinners, defiled sinners. And so the whole message of grace, of course, then comes streaming through here that God does provide in spite of the ultimate absolute insistence of his holiness to keep anything sinful out. Amazingly, he provides for multitudes, on multitudes to come streaming in, all of them in themselves sinners. So we are reminded that the angel of the Lord who reveals this vision to Zechariah was himself to be pierced by the flaming sword to open a way through the wall of fire and gain entrance for an innumerable multitude out of all nations. The wonder of the burning bush not consumed meets us again here in anticipation of Zechariah's next vision with the gospel of sovereign grace, of the brand plucked out of the fire, removal of defilement, and investment in robes of priestly glory. That's the next vision, and which I said we'd get to tonight. I'm beginning to wonder, but that's all right. Huh? Now then, that takes us through the symbol of the unwalled city and so forth, and brings us to the section which is a sort of a proclamation of the meaning of all of these things. And maybe I'd better let us take our break there, okay? Yeah, that'd be a good point to do that. Collect our wits. Pick up our our reading then with verse 10. In the Hebrew. I guess verse 14, would it be in English? The speaker is the same one that says, been speaking and saying, I will do this and the other thing. It's still the angel measurer who is speaking. His words, however, are no longer just being directed to this young man, Zechariah, but as you can see right away, they're addressed to the whole people of Zion, and indeed to the whole world. And he starts out then, ho, flee from the land of the north, says the Lord, for as the four winds of heaven pay rasti, is from a verb which usually means to spread abroad, which sometimes means to scatter, but certainly the normal meaning is the one that fits here. What we find in this section where there is an application being made of the basic vision that we've seen, the application keeps harking back to what has already been promised, namely that God will be with them and that he's going to bless them, the unwalled city. Now that's the message. And so in the application here, he keeps referring back to that fundamental thought of the promised expansion of the city. And therefore, in this case, he's saying, like the four winds of the heaven, it's a promise. It's not something I've done, but something that is motivation for you to return. The people of God are pictured in terms of their exile far from their homeland, and they are being called back to the center of God's cause because this is where the future really is, in spite of present appearances to the contrary. So like the four winds of heaven, I'm going to spread you in all directions, and that's why there won't be walls around the city anymore, because I'm going to spread you abroad. So you may be looking at an English version that says scattered. Anyone have such a translation? Let's hear it. How do they translate it?
Fleeing from the land of flee from the land of the north, for I have scattered you to the four winds.
Yeah, see, now that describes it as something which happened in the past, and would just be explaining why they are where they are, which isn't, doesn't make that much sense here, whereas what you're looking for is, why should we come back here? Well, because this is really where the future lies. It looks like it's lying in ruins and so on, but as a matter of fact, I'm going to multiply you so that it'll be like that city without walls. So, like the four winds of heaven, in all directions, in other words, I am going to spread you abroad, distribute you, says the Lord. So it's a promise. And the counterpart to it is to leave the area where they are now. It looks like that things are great there. All the glory of the world is located there in the Persian Empire and so on. But actually, it's doomed. Given the long eschatological outlook, the future is with God's people, not with the world, because the horns are going to be cast down. It's going to be the complete reversal, and the lowly will be lifted up. So verse 11 goes on, oh, back to Zion, flee. It's not an address. Ho, you people of Zion, escape. It's back to Zion. So leave Babylon and come back to Zion is the message. Ho, flee from the land of the north, Me'er et Zaphon. Flee from the land of the north. Ho, back to Zion, escape. You who are dwelling currently there with the daughter of Babylon, where you don't ultimately belong. For thus says the Lord of hosts, verse 12. Now we have, we did discuss this last week already. Aher Kavod, the messianic measurer, angel is speaking, and he speaks of himself as someone who has been, God has sent him on a mission, the Messiah, as the Father sends him on a mission. And he is either saying that in this mission, he has been sent after glory in the sense of in order to obtain or to achieve in quest of glory, or perhaps better, giving this Hebrew verb preposition acher, the meaning with, and kavod, the meaning of the Shekinah glory, kavod, cloud. Messiah is saying, you know, that he doesn't go on this mission, as it were, by himself, but he comes attended by the very glory of God. I mean, we can apply it in New Testament terms. It's expedient that Jesus goes away in order that he might come to us in the form of the Spirit and be with us in a fuller way and so on. And in the Old Testament, and we did cover this, I remember, and I discussed it in glory in our midst, there was the problem that Moses had to face when God threatened that after their sin, that he would no longer be with them in the form of his visible glory. He would simply send his angel without outward glory manifestations to lead the Israelites. And Moses complains, oh, no, we don't want the angel by himself. We want the angel with the glory cloud. And this language could fit that kind of thing very well. And so the messianic angel is saying, I was sent on a mission, you know, not without the presence of God's divine power and spirit, but precisely with the kavod, with the glory. In either case, it's on a mission of judgment. And so he is sent on a mission of judgment that is going to spell prosperity and blessing and fullness for the people of God. So either then in quest of glory or with the glory spirit, I have been sent unto the nations who spoiled you. So I'm being sent on that mission by God because God is one who is concerned about you. The one who touches you touches something which is as precious to him as the apple of his eye. We discussed that term, bivavat, the little daughter of his eye or something of that sort, but it's referring to his eye. And you are precious to God, and I've been sent on a mission of vengeance against those who have abused you. For behold, I will shake my hand over them. This is, again, Exodus-type imagery, like Moses lifting up his staff over the waters, over the Egyptians and so on, and doing miracles. And behold, I will brandish, shake my hand over them. And they, who have just been described, the nations who spoiled you, and they will become a spoil to their servants, which is you, of course. You have been the servants of your the oppressing nations. So here's that theme of complete reversal that we keep encountering. And they will become a spoil to you. Now what we want to explore then, is, as we said at the outset, was the different ways in which the nations thus become a spoil, in which they are plundered. And one is going to be in terms of the glory of their earthly property and holdings, but the fascinating one is in terms of they will be spoiled of their own citizenry, of their own people. And they will become a spoil to you. And the result of this will be, look, I have been sent. This is my mission. When it's accomplished, then you'll know that the Lord of hosts has sent me, that Messiah, that Christ is making a genuine claim when he says that the Father has sent him. This will be the validation of Jesus' claim to be the Messiah, that his messianic mission of building up the true Jerusalem and will have been fulfilled. Then you will know indeed that the Lord of hosts has sent me. And then he goes on with more imperatives of what in the light of these promises is the thing to do. And it's like the one we just saw in Isaiah, where he told the barren woman to sing and rejoice because your children are going to be more than ever before. And so here again, it's the same sort of verb that is used. Sing and rejoice, O daughter Zion, you who are currently living with the Bat Babel, the daughter of Babylon. You are the Bat Zion. You are the one who belongs properly here in Zion. So sing and rejoice. And why? And now we get a repetition of all the fundamental thoughts right from the first vision on the presence of God and all that betokens for God's people. For behold, I am coming, hineni va, v'shakanti b'tokeich, and I am going to dwell in the midst of you. There's our fundamental thought again, the rider on the red horse in the midst of the myrtles. I am in the midst of you. And so the future belongs to Jerusalem. It's going to become like a city without walls. And by reason of the multitude of men, we were told, and now that thought, the multitude of men, where do they all come from? And this begins to explain it. Because the goyim rabim, many of these nations, against whom I'm going in judgment, many of these nations, lo and behold, are going to be united unto the Lord. So the thought of the conversion of these nations, their conquest is going to involve conversion as well. So that many of these nations will find themselves united. We'll talk a little bit more about that verb, lava, to unite, and the way especially Isaiah uses it.
I don't know what nil wu means.
Pardon me?
It says banil wu in the beginning of verse 15. What does that mean?
To be united. The verb is lava, which means to unite with. And so they will be, many nations will be united unto, joined unto Yahweh in that day, and they will be to me for a people. Now here the whole distinctiveness of Israel is they were God's people, and the others are lo-ami, they are not my people. But in terms of the new covenant, now there's universalism. Now those who were strangers and aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and God's promises and so on, now are brought nigh. That's the whole Pauline emphasis, huh? And now the Gentiles are brought nigh, made fellow citizen with the saints, members of the same body, and so on. Here's the Zechariah's version of that. And they will be joined unto the Lord, and they will be to me as part of my people. And conceiving now of this new union of Jews and Gentiles, and God says, addresses them and says, and I will dwell in the midst of you, Christ dwelling by his Spirit in the midst of his church. And now, once again, having once again described the ultimate outcome of his mission in this way, he again says, this then will be the validation of my messianic claims. And you will know indeed then that Yahweh of hosts has sent me unto you. Every knee will be obliged to bow before the Lord Jesus and acknowledge that he is indeed the Christ. And then again, developing the thought of the promised blessing, it says, and the Yahweh will inherit Judah as his own portion, and yea, for as the site of his temple, is the way we translated this. Instead of saying as his portion on in the Holy Land. I think that misses the imagery. It's Yahweh is going to inherit Judah as his portion, semicolon. Yes, as the site of his temple, he's going to still choose Jerusalem. So the choice of Jerusalem in the language of Deuteronomy is always that thought of the city which I'm going to choose as the locus for my dwelling place, and it turns out to be Jerusalem. And so what he's saying here is that ultimate thought of what I was going to choose to identify with, where I would dwell and put my name and have my temple built, that's going to still turn out to be Jerusalem, not somewhere else in the world. Again, we keep reminding ourselves this is prophetic idiom, this is typological language, uses the old Jerusalem to describe what the book of Hebrews and book of Revelation tell us is actually the heavenly Jerusalem. Tells us that even Abraham knew that that's what God meant way back there. All right, so the result of all this then is a sort of final summary and summons, which I guess we just read sort of the final summary, and then the final summons is, hush, all flesh before the Lord, for he has arisen, he's been roused up from the site of his temple, he's going into action. Now then, getting back to comments on this in glory in our midst, it would be starting on page 78. Just before that, I tried to show the outline of this thing, whereas you have an imperative, and then you have motivation, you have another imperative and motivation. Do this, why? Because, look, I'm going to expand you. Do this, why? Because I'm going to judge them, and so forth. So that's the structure of the passage. And so here it's still the same speaker, Christ, the Kerux, the proclaimer, huh? The preacher. So Christ, the Kerux, heralds here he's the one who's speaking, and he is all prophesying beforehand. He heralds here his coming worldwide victory over the enemy. And he issues beforehand his efficacious altar call to his own afar off. So here's Jesus issuing the gospel call to his people who are scattered all over the place, calling them back to Jerusalem, to the temple, to the altar of God. His efficacious altar call to his own afar off to come home. It will be the completion of this universal mission that authenticates his claim to be the servant of the Lord sent by the Lord God of hosts. Well, the conquest of the nations, verses 10a and 11a. And we read through the text. This is where they're told to escape from Babylon, to return to Zion, the top of page 79. We discussed that verb, paras. The reason they're to come back here is because God promises that he's going to expand them or distribute them all over the place. Then going on to verses 12 and 13, the other motivation for leaving Babylon and coming back to Jerusalem, besides the future belongs to Jerusalem, is that the future of Babylon is one of doom. While return to Zion is encouraged by appeal to its promised prosperity, flight from Babylon, as flight from Sodom, is urged on the ground of its impending doom. Get out of Sodom and Gomorrah. Look what's about to happen to them. The two are closely related, Jerusalem's prosperity and Babylon's doom. They're closely related. Jerusalem's prosperity would be achieved through, now this is that distinctive new thing, we've had promises of blessing here, threat of judgment here. What's the connection between them? That's now coming out. The connection between them is that it's precisely by judging the world that God will shake loose their goods and bestow them on his own people. So Jerusalem's prosperity would be achieved through the plundering of Babylon. And they're reminded again that God does all this because he loves them. And then the bottom of page 79 and top is a discussion of that phrase, aher kavod, whether it means in quest of glory or with the glorious spirit. And in either case, it involves a threat of judgment against the nations. bottom of page 80. Again, in verse 13a, the disaster threatening Babylon is the consideration urged for obeying the command to flee from there. Messiah's mission against the world powers would resemble the ancient judgment on Egypt. It would result in a complete reversal, the plunderers becoming a spoil to their former servants, the nations at ease becoming a spoil to the people of God, just as the Egyptians were despoiled by their Hebrew slaves. Messiah would effect this defeat by brandishing his hand over them, etc. And then referring to Isaiah again, using that kind of imagery. Conclusion now on verses 10 through 13, page 81, second paragraph, summing up verses 10 through 13. What we have found in this first section of the proclamation, the kerygma, is that the measurer himself is central in the exposition of the imagery. He is the one who's going to carry out the judgments and so on. That the Messiah and his mission is the main theme of the vision becomes even more evident when we notice how each of these subsections concludes by pointing to the prophesied events in Zion and the world as validation of the divine sponsorship of that mission. And we'll come back to that thought of the validation. Meanwhile now, we look here at verses 14 and 15, which discloses a new aspect of Messiah's mission, a surprising development not suggested previously, and yet essential to explain the image of Jerusalem expanded to unprecedented dimensions beyond containment, namely the conversion of the Gentiles. All right, so verses 14 and 15, the exhortation to sing and rejoice, because God's going to come and dwell in the midst of them. And it was at Christmas time I was writing this article. You know, all these articles were published over 7 years in about 14 installments in the magazine Kerux, which was why I was working the Kerux language into this particular article. And it was also the issue that was going to be published at Christmas. And so I was working in this idea of Jesus as the Kerux, as the one who's uttering the Christmas evangel, "Behold, I come." That's the Christmas story here in Zechariah. So he heralds the Christmas evangel, good news for all people, joy to the world, the Lord has come, let all men their songs employ. All right. So these are the assurances, and centered between the two assurances that the Lord will come and dwell in the midst of you is the disclosure of a distinctive new aspect of Jerusalem's restoration prospects. Many nations will join themselves to the Lord. So here is where the judgment then is going to involve something besides conquest and destruction. It's going to involve conversion and a bringing of a remnant of the Gentiles out of the Gentiles to join the remnant of Israel in God's new Jerusalem. And now here, Ernie, is then that verb, lava, that you're asking about.
Yeah.
So the last clause is the covenantal formula used by Jeremiah, the God-people thing. Also, the verb lava, so let's see what it says now. The verb lava means to join. Elsewhere is used for covenantal alliance. Many nations will join themselves to you. They will enter into covenant with you. Reminiscent of Psalm 2, Psalm 83 pictures the nations taking counsel and entering into covenant together against God and his people. And a serious participation in this covenantal coalition is described by this verb. So I'm just trying to illustrate the use of the verb lava by showing how entry into a coalition would use that particular term. In Jeremiah 50, verse 5, the verb lava refers to the union of God's people with him in an everlasting covenant. So this is a covenantal term. Of most interest for our passage is Isaiah's use of lava for foreigners attaching themselves to Israel, 14:1, to the Lord, 56:3-6. Alternative terminology in these passages, if you look them up along with lava, is taking hold of God's covenant, keeping the Sabbath, which is the covenant sign, receiving the everlasting name that belongs to those in the new and everlasting covenant. So there's a variety of ways in which the Bible can describe uniting with God, coming into his covenant of grace and lava, the verb, is one of those. Many nations shall be covenantally joined. Incorporation of the Gentiles into God's covenantal people is a recurring theme in Zechariah. He indicates, moreover, that their status is to be one of full participation. You read some commentaries that say that Zechariah falls short of the notion of really universalism and full participation. He sees the Gentiles as coming in just as servants are in some subordinate status, but not as full partners in the covenant. That's not reading Zechariah properly. Full participation, including cultic privileges. As noted above, the picture of many nations joined to the covenant community is surrounded by the double promise, I will dwell in the midst of you. At the close of the passage, which forms the central spine of this book, after its account of the symbolic enactment of Messiah's royal priestly coronation, the prospect emerges of those, I'm just quoting here from Zechariah 6, those who are afar off will come and share in the building of the temple. So the Gentiles aren't just going to be there as lackeys and servants, that they are going to participate in the very building of the temple, which is the preaching of the gospel. That's what the Great Commission is all about. We are going gathering the living stones which are built up into this temple of God, and the Gentiles share in that. Likewise, the introduction to the second half of the book concludes with a prophecy that the Gentiles will take hold of the skirts of the covenant people. I'm just trying to show then that the idea of the inclusion of the Gentiles is pervasive in Zechariah, including now this interesting imagery that they will take hold of the skirts of the covenant people, saying, we will go with you if we have heard that God is with you. Now here's that interesting imagery, symbolism of taking hold of the hem of the garment, found in Zechariah 8:23. Taking hold of the hem of the garment was a sign of submission to authority. And this is biblical text, extra biblical text. For Gentiles to grasp the tasseled skirts of Jews was to join in the acknowledgement of Yahweh's sovereignty that was signified by those tassels on the skirts. It was to take hold of God's covenant, like those whom Isaiah described as being joined to the Lord and his people. This symbolic convention is reflected in the gospel episodes of individuals touching the border of the garment of Jesus, the true Jew and the Lord combined in one. Though not involving Gentiles, these instances embodied religious confession of the Lord, such as Zechariah envisaged when he talked about the Gentiles taking hold of the tassel skirts of the Jews. Elsewhere, again, this theme of the conversion of Gentiles, the conquest of the nations, the Gentiles involving conversion of some of them. And Zechariah 9 is a very good example of it. The first opening part of Zechariah 9 is the story of a new conquest of Canaan. The Lord himself is going to conduct it against and dispossess the Canaanites who are dwelling there so that God's people can take over, the Shemites can take over, and the Japhethites can join them there. In the midst of that, suddenly we read about some of the Philistines being converted. So, and they will be a people for our God. And they will be, I think it reads on, they will be like chieftains in Judah. The Philistines will be converted. And not just be servants, but they will be like chieftains. On a broader scale, now we're looking to the last chapter in Zechariah. This is all the way through Zechariah, the first part and the second part. On a broader scale, Zechariah foresees a remnant out of all the nations coming to Jerusalem. He says, to worship the King, Yahweh of hosts, to observe the Feast of Tabernacles. And this was in the tradition of Isaiah's assurance to foreigners who were joined to the Lord that they were to be welcomed into the heart of the service of sacrifice and prayer on the Holy Mountain, Isaiah 56. Not just as servants, but participants in the whole service of the temple. They would see God's glory, Isaiah 66. They would be admitted into the priesthood. So you can't... no distinction anymore. The middle wall of partition is broken down, and they are one new man, Jews and Gentiles, in Christ, all one kingdom of priests, one holy nation. God's purpose to make known the gospel unto the nations for the obedience of the faith had indeed been revealed by the scriptures of the prophets. We began this chapter by appealing to Romans 16:26 in order to show that the concept of the Gentiles, the universalism, the church, was not as dispensationalist claim, something found only in the New Covenant but missing from the Old Covenant. It's very much in the Old Covenant as well. Another aspect of Isaiah's large contribution to Zechariah 2 is the connection he makes between the themes of the conquest of the Gentiles and their conversion. This is the top of page 83. In his treatment of Gentiles joining Israel, the first stage finds these former strangers from the covenant assisting in the restoration of God's people, being joined unto them, and as he describes it on and around chapter 14, he doesn't develop beyond the thought, you know, that the former oppressors will now be serving the interests of the Israelites. But as he continues to develop the theme, he develops it beyond that. And he says that they, the captors and oppressors, are taken captive and are now ruled over. That's still the first part. But then in Isaiah's later resumption of the theme, this joining, the verb lavag, this joining of foreigners to the house of Jacob becomes a religious joining unto Israel's God. It becomes a gathering into the full fellowship of the covenant life and divine service. Now, I guess in the next paragraph, I use Isaiah 11 and Isaiah 19 as further material from the prophecy of Isaiah concerning Gentile conversion in connection with Gentile conquest. Excuse me, you can move down now to to the bottom of page 83. Zechariah's third vision contains the same association of ideas as Isaiah had up there. Thus, in our particular vision, the conversion of the Gentiles emerges unexpectedly as a consequence of the conquest of the enemy powers. And we looked at Zechariah 9, where the conversion of the Philistines, as we saw, came in the context of the conquest of the land. And in that passage in Zechariah 14, where they all come and join in the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles, you remember how Zechariah 14 begins. It begins with all of the nations gathering together to assault Jerusalem. And God goes forth and defends Jerusalem against this universal assault. And it's out of that counterattack of God on the nations of the world that there emerge a remnant of believing nations who come and join in the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles. It is particularly the act of the spoiling now. Oh, that's the point I want to concentrate now. The spoiling of the aggressor nations by their former servants that provides the basis for the idea of converts being won from the ranks of the enemy. In Zechariah 2:13, the spoiling of the nations is a dispossessing of them in terms of their worldly wealth and glory. So verse 13, I will shake my hand over them. They will become a spoil to their servants, and so on. That's a despoiling of them of their earthly wealth and glory. But then when you come to verse 15, it's a despoiling of them in terms of their people. And they, many nations, will be united unto the Lord and will become my people. Let's see here. The spoiling of the nations is a dispossessing of them, and the first in terms of their worldly wealth. It is not the same as the wresting of converts from them referred to in verse 15. The latter, verse 15, is a second kind of spoiling. It's an act of salvation. Those who move from the world side to the Lord's side as a consequence of the messianic angel's mission of judgment on the nations are to be viewed as having been captives themselves, captives of the enemy power, a prey that has been seized and is now set free. This spoiling of the nations is a redeeming of the nations. And so now I want to follow that trail from roots in Isaiah 49, through our passage in Zechariah and into the Gospels and into the Millennium passage in Revelation 20. That's what we do on pages 84 and 80 and 85 here. Let's see. If we follow the thematic trail of Messiah's redemptive spoiling of the nations on into the New Testament, we come in a straight course to the Lord's binding of the dragon, deceiver of the nations, in Revelation 20, And the place to pick up this trail is Isaiah 49, verses 24 and 25. So maybe if either in your English or Hebrew Bible. In Isaiah 49, we're going to be looking especially at verses 24 and 25, but if you cast your eye over the preceding part of that chapter, you'll see how he's been dealing with this theme of universalism. It's too small a thing for you to be my servant to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles, that you may bring my salvation to the ends of the earth. So this whole development we're talking about is embedded in what is precisely the messianic mission. That's what the Father appointed him to save God's people, who are the remnant of the Jews, but also the remnant of the Gentiles. This is what the Lord says. Redeemer and Holy One of Israel, to him who was despised and abhorred by the nation, to the servant of rulers. Kings will see you and arise. Princes will see you and bow down because of the Lord who is faithful. That was verses 6 and 7. Let's also glance at verses 20 and following. And this is so much like the other passage we read in Isaiah about the children of the desolate woman. The children born during your bereavement will yet say in your hearing, this place is too small for us. Open the tent flaps. Why, that's that thing again. This place is too small for us. Give us more space to live in. And then you will say in your heart, who bore me these? I was bereaved and barren. I was exiled and rejected. Who brought these up? I was left all alone. But these, where have they come from, all these Gentile kids? This is what the Sovereign Lord says. See, I will beckon to the Gentiles. I will lift up my banner to the peoples. They will bring your sons in their arms and carry your daughters on their shoulders. Kings will be your foster fathers and their queens your nursing mothers. They will bow down before you, their faces to the ground. They will lick the dust at your feet. Then you will know that I am the Lord. Here's that validation thing that we have in Zechariah too. When this is done, then you'll know that the Lord has sent me. Then you will know that I am the Lord. Those who hope in me will not be disappointed. Now we come to the passages that are right at the root of the Revelation 20 thing, it turns out, verses 24 and 25. Let's see what the Hebrew says here. it starts with an interrogative word, ha. Is it that the verb lakak means to take, that which has been taken, is it that the captive, or that which is taken. What words does the English use to translate this?
Show the prey the mighty, to show the prey
the no, but that's a better translation. Oh, so they translate this already, the prey, that which has been taken. All right.
The captive,
the captive they have already? Verse 24.
Shall the prey be taken from the mighty, or the captive?
Yeah, so they use the word prey. The verb just means literally to take. All right. So, let's say the captive of the strong man, the gibor is the word, like in the expression El Gibor, God the mighty, the hero, and gibor can be a military term, the warrior, you know. So here is the warrior figure, and he has his captives, and the question is, can the captive be taken? Of the warrior, the mighty warrior, be taken away. The noun there that they're translating captive is malkot. The verb is lakak at the beginning. Is it that there can be taken from the warrior his captive? And then, you know, synonymously it says, or can the prey, now here there's a little textual problem. The Hebrew reads zadik, which means righteous. But when the thought is repeated just below, it has the word aritz, which means the fierce, and that seems to fit better, so I'll just read it that way. Or can the prey of the fierce warrior again be rescued from him? No, when the mighty warrior takes someone, you're not going to get him, pry him loose anymore, is the thought. But yes, God says he will do that. That thing that seems impossible, God says he's going to do. Now see, here's where you're getting then your Christ and the dragon. Here is God versus Satan. Satan now has taken over mankind from the fall of Adam, and can anyone rescue those who are the victims of Satan from the dragon's clutches? It sounds impossible, but God says yes. Thus says the Lord, indeed, the captive of the Gibor will be taken from him, because God himself is going to do it. Yes, and the prey of this fierce one shall be rescued from him, because Genesis 3:15 is true, and God's going to send the Christ to trample on the head of the serpent and to set the captives free. And God promises that the one who enters into contention or strife with you, I will enter into contention with, and your sons I will save. So there is the imagery now of the rescuing, the prying loose of the captives of the fierce warrior. Now that's the kind of imagery I'm suggesting that we have here in Zechariah 2, which speaks about taking a spoil from them. But we want to see how this thought then is picked up by our Lord in the Gospels. And so here we want to turn to Matthew and to Mark and to Luke. And I have the passages noted here. If someone else can help me find them faster. That sounds good. Matthew 12:29. And the one in Mark will be similar. Okay, you have the Mark one there. What was Matthew 12? You said.
Matthew 12:29.
Okay. Let's try Matthew 12:29. So the thought now is that of course Jesus has been contending with Satan in the form of the demon possessed those who were captives of Satan in the form of that demon possession, and there's been the controversy of whether this is being done by Beelzebub or by the Spirit of God, and Jesus knew their thoughts and tells them if Satan drives out Satan, he's divided against himself. And if I drive out demons by Beelzebub, by whom do your people drive them up? But if I drive out demons by the Spirit of God, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. So that's the context. We know what he's talking about. He's talking about himself and his contending with Satan over those who are in Satan's clutches. And with that in mind, then he picks up this imagery from Isaiah that we have just been looking at, Isaiah 49. And he says, "Or again, how can anyone enter a strong man's house and carry off his possessions? How can you take the prey from the Gibor unless he first ties up the strong man? Then he can rob his house." And Mark 3?
Mark 3:27.
Should be about the same. Yeah, it's the same. And in verse 23, "And Jesus called them and spoke to them in parables, how can Satan drive out Satan," and so on. And you were right, verse 27 you said, didn't you? Yeah, verse 27. "In fact, no one can enter a strong man's house and carry off his possessions unless he first ties up the strong man, then he can rob his house." And now the one in Luke is interesting because it has not only the thought of taking away from the strong man his possessions, but it involves the thought that when you do that, you must first bind him. And so it's the binding of Satan. So now we want. Yeah, it's Luke 11. Hey, you're just in time to get into the millennium here, kid.
I've been waiting for
it. Oh, yes, sir.
We're already in it, right?
But this will tell you, since we're just getting into the millennium thing and in the third vision, that we probably aren't going to make the fourth vision tonight, huh? But we looked at the passage in Isaiah 49, where the rhetorical question is asked, can you take away the captive from the gibor, from the strong man? And then God says, yeah, he can do this. And then Jesus cites that in connection with his setting free the demon-possessed from Satan's clutches. And we read the Matthew and Mark versions, and now the Luke 11 version is the one we're interested in because it adds the element to the imagery of the binding of Satan. What verse do I want?
21.
21? Oh, yeah, good, okay. If I drive out demons by the finger of God, then the kingdom of God has come to you. But now when a strong man, Hebrew gibor, huh, fully armed, guards his own house, his possessions are saved. But when someone stronger attacks and overpowers him. Where is my nice binding? It's in this verse, in some version. Someone have some other version beside an NIV? What version do you have? Anyone have some?
The armor.
Yeah, that's a very loose translation of the verb, which is binding. You have binding? Yeah. Yeah, that's what's in there. And I would think the old King James, for one, would have the binding. But that is, it has the same thing? But now that I see this in the NIV, I remember reading through that and noticing that they blurred over the precise thought of binding and when talked about overpowering him. Let's see what if any.
Binds in Matthew 29.
Bind is in Matthew?
Yes, 12:29.
So Matthew is the distinctive one rather than Luke, then, huh? Matthew, what is it?
12:29.
Read it for us, will you? Oh, yeah, I had the wrong gospel as being the distinctive one, yeah. So Mark and Luke, then, are agreed on the more general type of language. But Matthew, then, thank you. 12:29? Oh, yeah, he first ties up the strong man. Yeah, that's what the NIV, that's where it was hidden under, that ties up. It binds how he ties up. Okay, thanks very much. So in Jesus' then treatment of it here, and then the Matthean version of it, he adds this detail to the imagery of the binding of the strong man, and we know it's a matter of dealing with Satan in such a way that those who are the captives of Satan are saved. They're redeemed. They're set free from their bondage to sin and death and Satan, and they become God's people, is plainly what the point of it is. So then moving on from there to the familiar passage in Revelation 20, where it is picked up again. And this helps us then to understand what is the nature of the millennium, what's going on during the millennium. I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss, and holding in his hand a great chain. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil or Satan, and he bound him for 1,000 years, threw him into the abyss and locked and sealed it over him to keep him from deceiving the nations anymore until the 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be set free for a short time. So the millennium is a time then when Satan's role as the one who keeps people in a state of religious deception and darkness and the lie and apart from the light of God's saving truth, when that is curtailed. So throughout Old Testament times, Satan is highly successful at it. This universalism of the unbounded Jerusalem that we're dealing with doesn't begin to become a reality really until the New Covenant. In the Old Testament, as we said earlier, you have this ethno-centralized things when the kingdom people are rather much restricted to Israel, when the blessing is on Shem, but the Japhethites haven't begun yet to be entering into the covenant tents of Shem, because Satan during this period is successfully the deceiver by and large of all the rest of the nations of the world. Now that begins then to be changed with the advent of our Lord and his own ministry, already dispossessing the demon possessed and launching the gospel into the world to the Gentiles, and in the power of the Holy Spirit attending to the preaching of the word. And so Satan's captives are being taken away from him, and in terms of this imagery, Satan himself is bound. And you can see then that you shouldn't be pressing the thought that during the millennium that Satan is not present or involved or doing anything. Of course he's present and he's doing something. But you have to determine in what sense he's being bound. And this series of passages we've just looked at tells us in what sense he's being bound. Namely, that he can't frustrate, he can't stand in the way of the successful penetration of the gospel to go out from Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, to the uttermost parts of the earth. Satan cannot stop that until God's purpose through his church is fulfilled, until the fullness of the Gentiles as well as the fullness of Israel have been gathered together, and then the time at last comes for this community to be consummated, to be glorified into the new Jerusalem, the one that is without walls and so on. But even that final step of God's consummating the covenant people, we have the sober warning that doesn't happen until Satan, who has been bound during the current age, the 1,000 years, is let loose again. So there was a pre-Christian time when Satan's character is that he's the deceiver of the nations. On a large scale, the world lies in darkness. That's not true now. In Revelation 11, the thought is that the church is portrayed as the two witnesses unto whom it is given to complete their mission of witness in the world. And there, the symbolism is in terms of what we found in the 70 weeks passage in Daniel, the 3.5 years representing the present church age. So throughout that whole present church age, no one can stop the two prophets until their witness is completed. However, there in Revelation 11, as well as in Revelation 20, that period comes to an end. The 3.5 year period comes to an end. The 1,000 year period comes to an end. The 1,000 years, viewing it from the point of view of the intermediate state. But the present church age comes to an end in each case. And then there is a severe but nevertheless brief interval when Satan, who is now bound, is let loose again. And the letting loose of Satan must be in terms of the binding of Satan. The binding of Satan is in terms of he loses his hold on all of God's elect who are delivered, who are redeemed from his clutches. And therefore, the loosing of Satan, the unbinding of Satan, as far as I can see, must signalize a return to almost an Old Testament, pre-New Testament situation, where the people of God are the hemmed-in community. In fact, that's the way Revelation 20 pictures this particular thing. It's in terms of the Ezekiel 38, 39, Gog, Magog, all the hordes of Antichrist humanity gather together and besiege the beloved city, so that the New Jerusalem, at this point, before it's glorified, is once again the little community that is the camp in the wilderness, besieged by the hordes of Satan, who once again is the deceiver of the nations. And so however, in actual terms, we are to understand what we're warned about here, that the time is coming when, as a missionary outreach, as my understanding of it, as a missionary outreach, we will cease to be effective, when the doors on a broad scale will be closed all over the world, and the Great Commission has pretty much been fulfilled, and now there is this crisis that in his wisdom God suffers to be so. It doesn't say that all Christians are going to be killed. It doesn't speak in terms of international conflicts and so on, but I think what it's speaking in terms of the progress of the gospel is somehow severely curtailed. And in the 11th chapter of Revelation, where it speaks about the two prophets, none can stop them, you know, as long as it's the age for the Great Commission, they do their thing. And but then when the time is up, then the beast that comes up from the abyss, the equivalent of Revelation 20, the Satan comes up unbound from the abyss. Same thing, whether we talk about the ultimate one, Satan, or his agent, the beast, same episode. Each one now is released from the place where they've been suppressed, and the beast comes up from the abyss in Revelation 11. And what does he do? He kills the two prophets. He closes their mouths. Their witness is silenced in their death. So you have two images that I think point to essentially the same reality. The mouth of the witness is closed in death. The community of the people hemmed in and besieged so that there's no influence going out. That speaks to me about a church that no longer is successfully penetrating the world with the gospel. And Satan is once again the deceiver of the nations. And so here's the final gathering of Satan, the final crisis, the final battle of Armageddon, which is not a battle of one nation against another. It's a battle of Satan against Christ. It's the Christ and the dragon, God and his people, Satan assaulting and challenging the Lord God Almighty and his anointed one. That's that battle. And the response of God is, of course, then to come quickly. And it is, as we said, severe, but it is a relatively brief period. And then God comes quickly and destroys the dragon and brings to pass this picture of the new God is the nature of the millennium. It's not some period of earthly glory for the people of God, not a whisper about earthly glory. In the one passage that describes 1,000 years, nothing is said about earthly dominance and glory. All it talks about is the things that have to do with this being the age of the Great Commission, and simultaneously the age of the Great Commission is the age of the Great Tribulation. And so it's the martyr age. Martyr sums up what the millennium's all about in both ways. It's the martyr age, and because it's the age when God's people are penetrating the world with the gospel, and Satan has been bound and can't stop them in that respect. And it's also the age in which, because of their witness, God's people are martyrs in the physical sense, that they are put to death. Now, this is what John sees. He sees the souls of those who have been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus. Huh? He sees the Christian dead. He sees them in the intermediate state, but they're in the intermediate state because they have been suffering. They are not politically dominant in the world. They are the suffering saints, witnesses for the Lord. Their mission successful, but sharing meanwhile in the sufferings of Christ that later on we may share in his glory. But that's what the Revelation 20 talks about, is Christians witnessing and suffering for their faith and yet successful. That's, of course, the reassuring thing, that Satan is bound and that our missionary efforts will be successful, and all of God's elect through the faithful preaching of the gospel will be brought into the kingdom, and so we can labor with the joy and with confidence that our labor in the Lord is not in vain. At the same time, have a certain sober awareness that there comes a crisis at the end of history for which the church should be prepared, nevertheless relatively short, and when needed, then that's when Jesus comes quickly and destroys Satan's Antichrist, Satan himself, and brings his people into the joy of this city that doesn't have walls, because God is the wall of fire round about us and the glory in the midst of us. Well, that's what I take it Zechariah's vision here is all about, and we didn't quite finish it in terms of what's here in Glory in Our Midst, but you can read that, and we did read the text, and notice again, especially there in 86 and 87, how it will be the fulfillment of all of this that we are just talking about, that will ultimately be the validation that, after all, Jesus was, as he claimed, the one who had been sent of the Father. So, and from that you can get into an interesting, I think, of study of biblical apologetics, huh? What is it that validates claims and so on? And there's something to think about. I won't try to get into it. I try to say something about it in that chapter. Well, next week we should then get to the central vision. Now, we've been trying to show how Satan or his presence keeps getting appearing in the text, but in this next one he appears openly. So the Christ and the dragon conflict comes right to the surface, front and center in that vision next time.